common denominator of the audience can only understand really simple things. And in doing that, I think it just makes everyone have dumber conversations, more simplistic conversations without, like, you know, because where do you go from there? Like, okay, the pigs killed this person. I mean, you can choose to do something about it, but it's a much, like, the thing we're talking about is more complicated of, like, how is suicide in the midst of a dying down uprising part of being murdered by that which you were rebelling against. That's like, that's a more complicated conversation to be having than just the bad guys killed the good guy or whatever, which is totally a part of the dominant narrative, is like the good guys versus the bad guys. And of course everyone thinks they're the good guys.
Yeah.
I don't know. A positive spin on this is, and you kind of began saying this too, Madison, is I like stories. Like, I like narratives. I guess maybe there's a difference between stories and narratives. And maybe we should talk about what that difference is. But I like people telling the story of their life, you know, or telling like the origin story of how they got into anarchy, for example. I really like hearing those. And that's still like, obviously the person is going to be putting a spin on it or is going to be telling it in a certain framing, but it seems I'm into that. I'm into hearing those things out and talking about them. I don't know. Is there a difference between stories and narratives?
Yeah, definitely. They're more, narratives seem more, I mean, I guess it depends on how you define narrative, but it seems it's in the way that this is defining, the topic is defining it, is it's more overarching, and stories are more individual and interpersonal between people, and they interact and they have to interact, and they're more verbal maybe, or more face to face, or just more, yeah, like have more, yeah, just inherently more complex. But because when you say something, people were around for that experience, maybe you're telling a story and then somebody in the room was there too, like there's a lot more depth to it, and the narrative sort of doesn't really have that. It's more of like a from above sort of story.
It's like a story meant for society or something, like it's meant for a broader audience that isn't interpersonal.
Yeah,
interpersonally related, I guess, to each other, or not like not actually connected in any way that isn't abstract.
But the narrative becomes stories you repeat to yourself, and that's the problem.
Yeah, you start embodying the narrative becomes embodied by the individuals, and then it becomes stories they tell themselves and turn it into something personal because they put themselves as one of the
actors in the story, in the narrative. Yeah. And also it's like the stories that you repeat or are repeated to you growing up, that's like basically the pieces of the narrative become sort of, yeah, socialization, all of this stuff. Like, we need this, we're doing this, we're dependent in this way on the state, right? That's the narrative from the state. But I think about, like, it's interesting because, you know, the internet is supposed to be something that, like, unites everyone to have access to the same ideas, right? Like, as imposed from above kind of thing. But what happened instead is there's just like this fracturing of a bunch of different interpretations. And because of algorithm, it makes everybody feel like validated and supported in their own narrative or stories. So I think there's an impossibility to narrative as well. I'm not looking to the internet as a model for how to be. It's more just that it backfired, is what I'm trying to say.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I disagree. I think it was intentionally done as a tool of alienation because it was created by the U.S. military.
Created by the reptilians.
No, like, I don't believe that the U.S. military was like, let's do this thing to unite everyone. Kumbaya. Like, that's not...
You think?
I don't think it backfired.
Well, there's different people who are also gunning for a different type of internet. Like, they're all the like fucking hippie people who are into it, and maybe they were, it was a lost cause, but there were different
narratives. You mean at the beginning of the internet, or
yeah, like the theory of the internet, a lot of it, I mean, of course it sprung from the military. It was like a way to have communication between the military internally or whatever, but there were people who were like, oh, the internet can be like a way of getting knowledge or something. Of course it, you know, didn't all work out this way, but there were competing ideas and narratives.
Yeah.
Ones that had less power than others. But so maybe you're right. Maybe the overarching thing was that the military or the government used it to sow discord. But I don't really know. I don't know if I agree with that.
Maybe I'm playing into the thing that we started out talking about, that I'm saying that I find it hard to believe that if the government was involved in the way that they were, which is basically by funding the entire thing and creating a lot of the infrastructure, most of the infrastructure, it seems, that they wouldn't be the ones that are actually deciding the direction it goes in. So maybe it seems like, yes, there's potential that people were subverting it, but I also like, I recommend people watch that movie, The Net or Das Net, the like German documentary that talks exactly about this and how there were different visions and they were, could be described as anarchic in some ways, but also it didn't go that way. Yeah, I don't know. It's an interesting topic for sure. And yep.
I think what I was trying to say is that I guess the way this, I feel like it affects my life is that if there's an idea of the narrative, it means that there's one solution to the narrative. Like if there's one problem, then there's one solution. And therefore people who have like a program feel like they're confronting the big bad thing. But in any part of myself or people around me or anarchists in general who play into that, like if we do this, then this will happen, like programmatic kind of like prescriptions to the big bad problem, the big narrative, it's like it all feels like part of the same trap. And so in all the ways that we think we know best for other people, that is a trap that fits into this big bad narrative, right? And so I think that what I notice when people believe a story as it's one monolithic event or chain of events or groups of people is they then think that they know the right way to navigate that or append that. And that's all they can see. That's all that's in there. They're not experimenting anymore, right? Like they're just following a program. And so, yeah, if you believe in a narrative, you believe in a solution to a certain extent, maybe. Maybe that's a leap though. I'm not sure.
Yeah.
Or you believe in a limitation of solutions, or that there can
be a solution necessarily.
There can be a solution that solves the whole thing for everybody involved.
Right, exactly.
Which, yeah, I mean, it's again, I'm contradicting myself because of what I'm doing, but by recording this, but I totally am against groups of people that don't know each other, or at least aren't like connected in some way that, you know, where they can like share space and this kind of thing, trying to have conversations and like figure out solutions together, just because it's like I don't think even 1,000 people can come up with a shared path, like it just without some level of domination and coercion. I think it's really hard to do that with 10 people, and that's fine, and it should be hard to do that in a real way with 10 people, and it's hard to do it with one friend a lot of the time. And to imagine that you can do it with a fucking country of people is to me completely absurd as an anarchist like project. I would rather people just be having these conversations in their friend groups with people they actually care about and know. But here I am recording this, like literally talking, you know, like kind of doing it. But whatever, I don't know.
What do you, maybe this is a slight change, but what do you all think of? Like, I've been thinking a lot about the terrain that I live in. Like, you know, there's the terrain is infused with the logic of private property. Like I'm not allowed to go in certain places if I don't have a key or know the people or whatever. And that's like a, to me, that's a very big curtailing of my behavior. And to me, that seems like a very materially real narrative of organizing terrain, but obviously it's not overarchingly like in control because people squat or they, you know, set up like encampments on land that they shouldn't be allowed to. And like, you know, there's like cracks within all of that, but there is, to me, like that still is like a very real thing. And sometimes if we get away from like believing there's like a narrative in some form, then you might not be able to see that, or like your politics or whatever you want to call it will be like kind of confusing or unprincipled or very, yeah, just like I don't know. I think there are things that I believe that need to be, to go away for other possibilities to open. And I don't think that, like, I know that in some way that's just like my own narrative, but I still believe in it and still think it's worthwhile. I don't, maybe I need to interrogate that, but I do, you know, there's just like ways that I'm, that we're all very much repressed and curtailed by institutions that actually have real power, but of course not full power. And maybe that's the like ungovernable, decentralized, chaotic good practices that just sort of tries to subvert the idea that this big, the big bad thing has all this power, but it does have power. It just like, it can be subverted. And maybe that's the whole point of this thing.
Yeah. I mean, I don't, just because something, it also has like an ethereal or narrative presence doesn't mean it also doesn't have like a physical presence. So I agree. Like, I think it's both, and, you know.
Yeah, I mean, to me, this, what you're describing is why I am into counterculture. Like, because it is a way of creating a set of practices that then contribute to creating a culture that is counter to the dominant narratives. So, like, I like to use shoplifting as an example, but, you know, there's other things as well. And shoplifting isn't some holy grail thing that sometimes it gets talked about that way too. But like, you know, the thing you're describing with private property, obviously that's a limitation that is both a narrative and physical limitation to what we can and can't do. But then I think in the kind of group of people that I'm in and have been for a long time, if you can call it community or not, like, there is a counter narrative or a counter story that says that you don't have to respect those laws, and actually it's kind of better or more fun or more interesting or more anarchic to just try to steal what you can. And that's just like a small part, right? I mean, there's other things to it too. You brought up squatting. I think that's a great like example of a counter story that builds a counterculture, because like, if we're talking about these narratives having real implications on our lives, like, it's one thing to just create counter narratives, and it's a different thing to say, okay, we're going to try to live a different story than the thing that's trying to be imposed on us. And what does that look like? And it's going to look differently for different people, but that's, I think that's how you create a counterculture, is creating a set of practices like that and then actually trying to live them as much as you can. And that's, I think to me, that's like, I mean, it's an individual project. It's a community project, as much as our friend groups can be talked about as communities. But then the more expansive it gets, the more free it gets. You know what I mean? Like, the conversations we're having become more interesting as different people get involved in a real way, you know, not just like on an internet forum or something, which is also can be, I'm not just trying to shit on like the comments of ANews. I think actually we kind of made a joke about it earlier, but I think actually sometimes it's pretty good, especially lately. But so, I mean, those things can be cool too, but whatever. I don't want to go too far into it. That's not what I'm talking about, I guess, when I say community. I'm talking about people actually like consistently sharing space with each other, caring about each other, going through the mundane together and sharing life through these like, yeah, counter stories, countercultural practices. But yeah, I mean, I agree. Obviously they have real, obviously these narratives have real implications on who we are, our limitations. Private property is a really good example. I mean, all the things kind of brought up here, I think are good examples. I mean, civilization is really good, I think too, because it actually is like killing us as we're living in it and the things around us. And that's like a real, real serious material limitation to what we can create or be a part of. But yeah, I don't know. That means it's, to me, that just means it's, I want to create a different culture with different stories, kind of going in circles, but maybe I've made my point.
What would your new narrative be?
My new narrative? Holy shit, that's a question. I feel like it deserves more thought than I can just blurt out right now. Yeah. I mean, probably the narrative would be that there's no narrative or something like that. That I want the biggest amount of stories to be told and listened to as possible, and for people to feel empowered to tell their stories to each other and to hear each other, try to hear each other the best they can, and just to exercise their imagination and creativity with the people they want to do that with. And to me, that implies an antagonism with the state and the dominant narratives, because I agree with you, Cam. Like, I don't think that the kind of thing I'm describing is actually, it's not that it's impossible, but it's very limited by the larger kind of situation we're in, which includes all of these keys, hierarchy, patriarchy, property, all these things. So, yeah.
Yeah. There's definitely a pretty clear need for some amount of destroying, you know, like, not gonna lie, gonna say it. Like, there are, like, things that we could, like, live in the shell of, like, if maybe the world fell apart and we were able to live more free. But, like, you know, maybe I want to get rid of streets or something. Like, they're covering the concrete's covering, you know, the proverbial beach or whatever.
I was about to make a joke about it.
We all know it. But, but, you know, just, like, there are things that, like, with a more, to me, like, a more expansive imagination, you know, of course, would require some amount of, like, uprooting, destruction, because, like, you know, yeah, like the example of getting rid of a street or, like, getting rid of, like, pavement, like, there might be people who are, I don't know, even more practical, like, you live in this, like, a house that is very historic and, like, looks cool, but, like, it isn't, like, doesn't stay cool or warm very well because it's got bad insulation or it's, like, made out of brick and, like, it takes a lot of energy to heat that up. So, like, maybe you want something different and, like, you want a more, like, a more interesting dwelling that wasn't created by, like, this sort of, like, an economic logic of, like, we'll build these things because there's just a lot of, like, somebody has control over, like, the idea of how you should build a thing, and that's with bricks or something. And, like, just, like, I don't know, trying to be, like, what would you get rid of and what would you keep? This is the question, or I don't know.
Wasn't there that one magazine cover that said for no thing against everything? Do you remember? It was FTP, maybe.
Some ignorant, yeah.
I mean, yeah, of course. I think a fair amount of destroying is in order or something. Like,
a transformation, I don't know.
Yeah, I mean, it doesn't have to be one or the other, or, you know, my approach, as much as I can help having an approach that isn't just reactive, is that I'm trying to create counter stories or live counter stories with people. And then you run into limitations, you run into these barriers, either in yourself because of your condition, or in myself because of my conditioning, or, like, physical barriers, like property and things. And then, like, once I run into them, I can say, like, okay, this is the thing that I can consider attacking or using for a different purpose. But just, I mean, I think it's fine to spend a fair amount of time theorizing about these things and, like, trying to imagine who our enemies are or what the things that we want to destroy at some point are. But to me, I've been trying to more, like, yeah, live a free life. And then once I run into a barrier, it's just like, okay, well, this is the thing I got to destroy, you know? Or, like, I run into a barrier, for example, in my head or in my spirit that is conditioned by, say, civilization or patriarchy. And I'm like, well, that is a limitation that's been placed upon me by an institution that I now want vengeance on, basically. Or I just want to chip away at it as much as I can, either in, like, yeah, sometimes in physical ways as well, you know, in material ways. So, yeah, I'm not just saying, like, let's create a counterculture and run away. Like, I think do that as much as you can, and then you're going to see that it's impossible, and then identify the thing that's limiting your possibilities and consider attacking it in whatever way you can.
How do you attack a narrative?
Well, I guess it depends. What can you be more specific?
Well, I feel like the things that hold us back often are prevent our connection with other people are the stories we tell ourselves about what those interactions mean. Like the narrative about what is possible.
How do I attack that narrative?
Mm-hmm. Or you can.
I mean, different ways. I mean, you can consume that narrative less. You can... fuck. I mean, I don't know. Yeah, you can physically attack the infrastructure that makes the dissemination of that narrative possible. Mm-hmm. That is a thing that people do. You can create and share counter stories. Yeah, I mean, or all of these things all at once. Mm-hmm. And there is also, I mean, I think it's important to attack these things in yourself as well. Mm. And as I do that more and more, I feel like it gives me the energy to do different kinds of attacks. Like, I think the things feed off of each other. It's not, there's no reason to just pick one. Like, I think this, I don't think this debate's really happening anymore. Maybe it is in some circles, but the like lifestyleist versus revolutionary thing doesn't make any sense to me. Like, I think the things, as I understand them, feed each other. Like, you live a certain life and it helps you like move towards insurrection or revolution or whatever, but like, I don't know why you would think you'd have to pick just one. That seems like some silly talk.
Yeah, I think I'm more interested in how people live their life and what they're trying to do and what they're trying to create.
What do you think, Cam? How do we attack the narratives that are keeping us down?
I don't know. I mean, the first thought for me would be, if it's just like a problem of not communicating it, communicating an alternative or a different possibility, you just communicate it with the people around you who are interested and challenge that. Or maybe they, you know, within that, there's like a challenge back at you and you just have this sort of continual conversation. But also, I think maybe I feel like the power of just doing things, starting to do things, maybe not like because you feel like you're obligated to change the world or do whatever, but like if you feel like you want to have more space in the world because you feel isolated, or like maybe you, like if there's something you want, like, and you think about it a lot and you just start doing it, and then you come to some clarity from doing that sometimes, maybe you realize it's not as easy as you thought, or maybe people aren't interested, or you just like, you, it's like a tactile approach to just like cracking the narrative. But I guess maybe you need some intellectual like willpower as well to do that, and also people. But so yeah, I think about that, like that's like a way of attacking narratives. But also that's like very experimental, and those experiments can kind of fail kind of miserably when you can be downtrodden from that, or feel very downtrodden from those failures. And I think that's like the real question for me, is how to continue like to just like get back up and not like lose in that sense of like experimentation or possibility. I think that's like something I really struggle with, because I've had, you know, I just have had things, I've done different experiments with people or lived in different situations with people, and they've been really good or they've been terribly imploded, and I don't want to keep living in that. I want to somehow move from that, but it's hard not to. So yeah.
You mean like living in nostalgia?
Yeah, living in nostalgia, living in a past narrative that you think that maybe isn't even real. You know, maybe there was conflict within that experience that you didn't see at the time, or like didn't confront or whatever, or like, you know, it's just like how to like suss through all that is also hard, because memory is part of your trajectory or how you respond to what's next or what's in front of you sometimes, or it's a very strong thing that makes you, you know, respond in certain ways to things in front of you.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I think it's okay to sit in the feeling of disappointment for, if you need to, or
yeah,
if we need to for a while. And then at a certain point, it does also become a barrier to living the life that we want or it can. But I don't know. It seems like also is a way of learning from past experiences.
Yeah.
I mean, Diane De Primo's thing of the secret is to really begin. Is something I think about. Isn't that hers?
I think that's
That Dagger's Drawn.
It's That Dagger's
Drawn. That Dagger's Drawn.
I thought that was one of her publications. No, I'm fucking around. Wait, I thought that wasn't a... Okay, I'm not going to argue, whatever.
I've always joked that I want to have like a TED Talk-esque thing where I talk about The Secret is to Begin, because it's just our current time. It's like that slogan is like still really helps me, but it also like is sort of cheesy in that way, you know?
Okay, okay.
It's really real. You just have to begin.
You just gotta start. No big deal. Just start.
It's true. Like, it is true. Because I tell myself this kind of often because it's easy to get stuck in my head sometimes.
Yeah.
And so just trying to do shit and not overthinking the way it will go or that I will think it will go usually is kind of a better approach.
Right.
You know, than just like assuming it's gonna fail or it's gonna be boring or whatever. Usually things are at least way weirder than I think they're gonna be.
I mean, I think that's about resiliency, right? Like, I don't know. I think about what you're saying, maybe under the lens of like a Willem Wright kind of character armor situation where it's like you have an experience and you build a protection to that experience and then that protection becomes a barrier. And that's how I think about my sort of experiments that didn't go the way I wanted, you know, but I still learned something from them and it informs how I approach the next thing. And if that is limiting, then maybe that's something where, the secret is to begin and just try. But, you know, sometimes those kinds of lessons are also, you know, I'm not saying anything new here, just could be many different ways of interpreting it. Like, I've learned a lot of lessons that I'm grateful for, even if it came through personal pain or community pain. I think those lessons are really important in the way that in what I value now and what I want. But I do think it takes a certain amount of awareness of the slant that we have when we're, or the narrative that we have, or the story that we have when we're looking at something, to be aware of our limited view, right? Because of those experiences. So I agree with you, is what I'm trying to say.
Well, it's beyond just individual memory. It's the sort of collective memory of it too, you know?
Of course.
And so like, you have to have space to work through that. And it's actually very hard to do that, turns out. And then it can easily create, if you can't do that, it can create a historical narrative of what happened that is, you know, coming from like a very atomized individual understanding because you haven't worked through it collectively or something. So that's key. And I don't think that's impossible. I just, you know, I think it's just like, it's hard, you know? That's how the big streamlined narratives come about. So is the inability to do that even on a small scale sometimes.
Yeah, I'm down to call it if anyone has any, unless somebody has closing thoughts.
As Diana DePrima said, the secret is...
where are you going with that?
That's the closing thought. I don't know. Why is it ended with a banger, you know, from, you know, legend.
Yeah. As Diane DePrima said, you miss 100% of the shots you don't take.
Exactly.
No, I love her. Everyone should actually read real things that she said. She's awesome. Thanks everyone for listening. And thanks for everyone for talking as well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah. Have a good week.
Have a good week.
This week's podcast was sound edited by Octox. The What's New was written by Chisel and read by Chisel and...
Blix, the most loathsome of goblins.
Why is he so loathsome?
I don't know. You'd have to ask Tim Curry.
I'm asking you. It's your name. How are you loathsome?
Because he's got long nails and a long nose and he's green.
None of that sounds loathsome to me.
That's pretty loathsome.
No, loathsome is when you have really, really smelly farts. We hope this podcast is useful to and fun for anarchists and the anarcho-curious. What? Really, really, really smelly farts. Not just
smelly
mildly.
Farts. That's,
no, not
that's
just smelly farts. No, seriously smelly farts. Seriously. Do you not understand what seriously means?
No. Yeah.
At around 10:30 p.m. on May 29th, 2020, a crowd of more than 1,000 people gathered in North Portland's Peninsula Park and marched downtown to the Justice Center, headquarters of the Portland Police Bureau. The direct inspirations for the march were the murders of George Floyd and Breonna Taylor. Many in attendance also had a strong desire to express solidarity with protesters in Minneapolis. That's what brought Chris Wise, a volunteer protest medic, out into the streets that first night.
Initially, I came out because, as an African-American, you know, it was that straw that broke the camel's back on just, like, one death too many. We are murdered by police and other law enforcement agencies at a rate of 3 to 1 when compared to the average white American. And those numbers get a little funky because, you know, obviously more white people die a year than black people in police-related shootings. But there are also, you know, 6 times as many white people than black people.
Tristan, another black Portlander, didn't go out that night, but he watched everything that happened on the live streams.
Honestly, like my first impression was that it probably wasn't going to be much. You know what I mean? Like, mm-hmm. I didn't expect it to blow up the way it did. I kind of felt like, because I've seen it happen in the past where, you know, there'll be some kind of like something happening like nationwide or another city, and Portland will kind of like, you know, show up in solidarity for it, and it might become something, but usually it's kind of like a one-off. So that's kind of what I was expecting. And so I was pretty surprised to see like how quickly it grew, and then also how the police were responding, like in like a very tear gas kind of way.
Mariah is a photojournalist and a lifestyle photographer. She was out at Peninsula Park for the very start of the march.
It was the beginning to, you know, something that not a lot of us knew we were going to get into, you know, but gosh, I remember being at Peninsula Park and it was really great to see everyone there. And like, it just reminds me of some, I hate that it's like a routine thing for us because it's, you know, why we're still fighting and why we've been fighting so strong. But, you know, when someone gets killed by, you know, via police brutality, everyone meets up, you know, maybe we protest for a few days and like, you know, quote unquote, we go back to like normal life. But, you know, we already haven't been in normal life since it's been a pandemic this whole freaking year. But it was really beautiful to see all the people and all the signs and the speeches.
The sidewalks bordering Peninsula Park were filled with different slogans and exhortations written in chalk. One of the most striking statements was, "Make the moment count." As it turned out, the city of Portland took that to heart. The crowd at Peninsula Park marched nearly 5 miles to downtown Portland. There they merged with a crowd that had gathered around the Justice Center. The moment both groups met was powerful. You could taste the energy in the air. Portland's 2020 Black Lives Matter protests had actually started several days earlier, before that mass gathering on the 29th. A handful of activists of color had begun occupying the steps of the Justice Center immediately after George Floyd's murder. One of them was Tracy Molina, an indigenous Portlander better known as Koska.
Well, I remember it wasn't not long after the George Floyd story broke. A lot of us wanted to do something here, but I think most of the regular organizers kept saying, wait, you know, let's wait for this, let's wait for that. And then finally, then Danielle James, you know, I think she's a pretty prominent black activist in this community and stood up against Patriot Prayer and Proud Boys and other white supremacists for years, was kind of the spark for that. You know, she said, like, we shouldn't wait. And then I supported her. I said, I don't think we should wait either. I think we should do something now. And so we ended up on the 27th at 10:30, all meeting at ICE and starting the protest there. And then we moved sometime after midnight. We moved over to the Justice Center and slept on the steps there and planned to occupy it as long as we could. And so we stayed there. And then there was only maybe like 4 of us that slept on the steps. And then the next day, like at ICE, we had about 30 to 40 people And then the next day, after we stayed on those steps, I would say there was about 40 or 50 people that showed up in the afternoon, and they did a direct action where they blocked off the streets in front of the steps of the Justice Center. And I think they did it, also did a die-in. And that night, there was also an impromptu direct action where some people, some young women sat in the doorway of the Justice Center, and they brought riot police out for that. And there was, at the time, there was only about 20 of us, and only like 6 people participating in the sit-in, but they still brought riot police out, and they were violently removed. That made the news because one of the women that was hit with a baton, she was actually pregnant, a black woman. And the only reason why I know that for sure is because after she was in the ambulance, she came, I don't know if she went to the hospital, but after she was in the ambulance, she returned paperwork from the ambulance proving that she was pregnant and was, you know, showing that some of the police officers that were still standing around. But yeah, that's how the first few days went. And then we we're going to have a rally at Peninsula Park. And then I agreed to do part of the opening. And when I was there, more and more people kept coming, and I was surprised that there were so many, I don't know, maybe 1,000 people there. I don't know. There was a lot of people there. I was surprised. And it just kept getting bigger and bigger.
The now merged crowd, which numbered at least a couple of thousand people, marched back to the Justice Center. For a few minutes, they stood outside, chanting George Floyd's name. The police were nowhere to be seen. While most of the crowd stood out in the street, 100 or so people gathered in front of the windows of the Justice Center. They started spray-painting slogans on the glass. A few people peed on the doorway. Someone lit a small fire out in front. And then, quite suddenly, one person broke a window. The first broken window set off a frenzy, and soon people were using their feet, rocks, and any tools they could find to shatter every exposed piece of glass on the building. With the window shattered, protesters ran into the Justice Center, ransacking police offices and setting small fires. The Portland police arrived a little bit later and began showering the crowd with tear gas and flashbang grenades. Though no one knew it at the time, events had just been set into motion that would lead to more than 100 consecutive nights of protests and tear gas. The Portland Uprising had begun. We crooked. We should probably start by talking a bit about the definition of a riot. Legally, anything the cops declare a riot is a riot. May 29th is generally referred to as Riot Night because, after the crowd was dispersed from the Justice Center, hundreds of people ran through the streets of Portland's luxury shopping district, smashing up high-end chain stores while the police chased after them. It certainly felt like a riot, but a number of the folks that we interviewed actually disagreed. Alan Kessler, a Portland-based lawyer, pushed back on that description.
I guess I disagree that even the first night was a real riot.
Okay.
I mean, there were some shops got burgled. There were some things stolen. There was a fire in the IJC.
Yeah.
I'm not sure that I don't know the intent there, right? Like looking at the piddly fires I've seen, I don't know if anybody means to burn the buildings down or to.
Yeah.
I don't know. It didn't seem like it. It doesn't seem it. If I were going to burn down a building, I would use a hell of a lot more accelerant than it seems like people are using. I don't know. I was struck by even on that night, I was struck by. Excuse me.
Oh, yeah.
I want to clip
that. Use a whole lot more accelerant out of context.
Yeah, please don't.
Alan Kessler says.
Yeah. I'm trusting you all.
Yeah.
The freedom's in your hands.
No, we're piping this straight to Andy.
So, no, even that night, I was struck by Commissioner Fritz, who I have absolutely no love for, who seemed just horrified that Gucci got robbed and didn't seem able to put that in any kind of context. I didn't see that as a riot. I didn't think that people wanted to just break shit. I think even then it was political. It was a protest, and it, you know, I wouldn't recommend that people break stuff or steal stuff or set stuff on fire, but I understood the upset, and I just didn't see it in those terms. And it didn't seem like, I don't remember that anybody died. I'm sure somebody was hurt, but I don't remember that it was particularly severe that evening. Like, I don't remember that as a violent night. I remember it as a night of property damage. Yeah, and I wasn't making a legal distinct. That was more of a moral argument. Sure. Like, I think people put a moral import behind riot, and I don't think it was that. I don't think it was a breakdown in civilization. I think it was a extremely heartfelt frustration with a system that wasn't meeting people's needs.
Max Smith, a Portland-based activist and live streamer, called it a riot light.
I called it like a riot light that night, I think. I was like, that seems like a little kind of a riot light. They broke a couple windows, you know, they sacked the Apple store, of course, you know, some opportunists is going to, you know, take that opportunity. If things are getting broken, someone's going to rob the Apple store. It's dumb because you're going to get caught, but go ahead and rob the Apple store. But, you know, that's kind of what I thought of it. Like, some stuff's going to get broken. That's what happened. And I actually thought the police, you know, I thought that, and actually thought there was going to be some change, which we saw a couple of things. Like, they started talking about, you know, canceling the DVRT and the cops in schools and things like that. And since then it's been fairly tame, and we haven't seen a whole lot of progress. So, you know, I felt like it worked a little bit.
The point Mac made is one that a lot of activists would agree with. Property damage, they argue, is not nearly in the same moral realm as injuring or killing human beings. Mac himself was not out on the 29th, but he was most directly inspired to start protesting because of something else that happened that day, hundreds of miles south of Portland, in San Jose, California.
There was a guy named Derek Sanderlin in San Jose, and he was protesting against the murder of George Floyd in solidarity with Minneapolis. And I remember waking up and getting on my phone and kind of just flicking through things and seeing that this man had been shot in the testicles with a rubber bullet, and it like required like emergency surgery, and like he's probably never going to have kids. And I'm looking at this dude, and he's like 27 years old. He's like a black dude. He's got dreads. He wears glasses. He's got a scrappy ass beard like mine, you know? And I'm looking at this guy like, man, that could have been me. And then I keep reading, and he was like a teacher. He taught the police about like not targeting people or whatever, or like, you know, de-escalation tactics or whatever. And I'm like, you're telling me they shot a dude that trains them? Like, this has got to be one of the craziest things I've ever heard in my life. And he could have died from this, you know? And that just made me so mad. And I was like, it's, even if it wasn't, you know, it wasn't me, it could have been me if I would have been out there. And so I was just like, that's insane. Like, this should not be a thing at all. This can't be real.
Many protesters and some journalists will argue that most of the riots Portland saw this summer were not cases of protesters rioting, but were instead cop riots. After all, if people breaking windows and looting an Apple store is a riot, then police driving into crowds, throwing grenades at random, and tear gassing hundreds of innocent motorists probably counts as a riot too, right?
This is the Portland Police Bureau. This has been declared a riot.
We crooked.
May 29th was not the first night of Portland's BLM protests, but it was the night that set the tone for the next 100-plus nights. There was tear gas, flashbangs, armored cops fighting demonstrators who were armed with, in the beginning, cardboard signs and water bottles. Now, we're going to cover a lot of ground in this series, and it's probably best to kick this off by giving everyone an overview of what exactly happened in Portland from late May to the end of September, because the mainstream media only really showed a portion of this story. Late on the night of the 29th, the people of Portland learned that their mayor, Ted Wheeler, had actually been out of town visiting his mother. His first response to what had happened was a tweet that started with the word "Enough!" in all caps and ended with a promise that he was coming back now. Now was also in all caps. City Commissioner Joanne Hardesty, who was acting president in the mayor's absence, declared a state of emergency and enacted a curfew from 8 p.m. until 6 a.m. At this point, Portland was in the same boat as many other American cities, including New York and Los Angeles. In Portland, the curfew was not enough to clamp down on unrest. Quite the opposite, in fact. Local activists like DSA member Olivia Cotby-Smith were inspired.
I just thought that it was not like anything I'd ever seen before. I'd never seen that level of destruction happen at a protest before. It was exciting. I was like, we're going to start. This is huge. This is going to take off all across the country. It's happening in Portland. It's happening in Minneapolis. Like, this is the start of a revolution. And even knowing that that might not be true, that's the feeling that I had that night.
Several thousand people gathered again on the 30th, and on the 31st, nearly 10,000 Portlanders marched to the Justice Center.
We actually sort of organized the protest behind the scenes, and got like 10,000 people across the bridge, which was awesome. It felt like the sky was the limit at that point. Like, I can't believe there are 10,000 people showing up every single night. Like, this has never happened before. We have to turn this into something.
Both times, police eventually dispersed the crowd with indiscriminate tear gas use and liberal clubbing with truncheons. Thousands of protesters were gassed, but so were hundreds of motorists who happened to be out on city streets, and dozens of houseless individuals who were gassed in their tents for no apparent reason. The curfew was rescinded in early June. It clearly hadn't helped. Next, the city began to build what would become a massive fence around the Justice Center. The protest movement started to splinter between a large group of demonstrators who engaged in daily marches that avoided police contact and a smaller group who repeatedly confronted police at the fence. At first, Portland police would gas and grenade any group of people that drew close to the fence, along with any motorists who happened to be driving nearby. Protesters started calling it the sacred fence because law enforcement seemed to value it more than the physical well-being of Portlanders. The first fence war between protesters and police lasted most of June. There were occasional protests at other police buildings, like the PPA, headquarters of the Portland Police Union, and the North Precinct. Smaller groups of activists also engaged in what was briefly a nationwide practice of pulling down statues of famous white supremacists. On June 18th, a small number of mostly teenage Portlanders toppled a statue of George Washington. This prompted President Trump to create an executive order to protect statues, monuments, and federal property. He sent dozens of federal agents to Portland to enforce this new order. The first time the feds made a large appearance was on July 4th. That night was a turning point for a number of reasons. After weeks of declining numbers, more than 1,000 Portlanders showed up outside the Justice Center to shoot commercial-grade fireworks at its windows. They fired a few at the adjacent federal courthouse as well. The police LRAD, a car-mounted loudspeaker, started warning everyone not to shoot the courthouse. So, of course, the entire crowd swarmed around the building and continued shooting it with fireworks. Suddenly, wooden hatches opened up on the front of the fortress-like building, and the federal agents inside began tossing out tear gas grenades and shooting impact munitions into the crowd. For a few minutes, the scene resembled a cross between an acid trip and a medieval siege, with protesters bombarding the courthouse with fireworks while the feds inside pumped out gas and riot munitions.
This is the... Oh, Jesus Christ. Yeah. Friday night, everybody.
Eventually, the fight spilled out into the street, and for several hours, Portland police and Department of Homeland Security agents engaged in a running battle with hundreds of protesters. Fireworks provided the activists with their first weapon that could disrupt a police riot line, while law enforcement responded by escalating physical violence even further.
I was walking up from the JC up towards the park blocks, and there was a person who was essentially having an asthma attack and a cloud of tear gas. And they had one buddy with them, and it was just such an impossible project for that one buddy to sort of haul them out of tear gas while they're having an asthma attack and like a panic attack and really having a rough time.
Everything got more serious after the 4th. Federal agents started responding to protests downtown more often than the Portland Police Bureau. A week later, federal agents almost killed a protester named Donovan LaBella by shooting him in the forehead with a less lethal round. Slowly, the mainstream media began to realize that something strange and terrifying was happening in Portland. The national interest was finally piqued a few days later when camo-clad feds in a rental van started kidnapping people off the streets. In early July, the 4th excepted, most nightly protests only numbered a few dozen to 100 or so protesters. But national media and the specter of federal snatch vans panicked Portland's liberal majority. By mid-late July, thousands upon thousands of protesters were showing up in the street every night. The time between July 18th to the 30th, dubbed the Fed War, is the stuff most Americans saw from Portland in the news. Moms and dads, veterans, doctors, chefs, and students gathering in front of the federal courthouse, chanting demands, banging on doors, setting fires, ripping off plywood covering the windows, and repeatedly tearing down that massive fence. Whenever the federal agents came out, a shield wall of protesters would form, deflecting metal tear gas canisters and flashbangs up into the air. People armed with leaf blowers directed gas back at the feds. In response, the feds started using experimental new weapons, including a pesticide sprayer jerry-rigged to spew poison gas.
Seeing the police attack people, especially the feds, when the feds came, when they came and started attacking people like in the smoke after I got like a gas mask and started going into the smoke, you know, and seeing what was going on in there, I was pretty disturbed by seeing the way that they were like beating people under the cover of tear gas. That was a surprise for me. I'd heard people saying, I got my ass kicked in there, but I didn't know it was going down like that.
As July came and went, so did the visible federal presence downtown. Most of the more liberal types packed it up, calling the protests a success. But while the days of walls of camouflaged feds had temporarily ended, despite reports of their withdrawal, federal presence in Portland lingered on for weeks. Dedicated activists were not fooled by the faux withdrawal. They knew the work was far from over. Throughout August, protesters gathered in front of police precincts, city buildings, and Portland's ICE facility. Sometimes they engaged in property damage, but more often they just stood in the street, yelling at the cops until they were inevitably charged by riot lines. It was in August that Portland first saw right-wing counter-protests, generally framed as Back the Blue or MAGA gatherings. Sometimes these escalated into street brawls between Proud Boys and left-wing activists. On several occasions, Proud Boys and other right-wing vigilantes threw homemade explosives and shot paintball guns into crowds. Live rounds were even fired into the air and into crowds. The escalation continued until a Trump caravan of vehicles waving flags drove through Portland in late August. Several Trump supporters fired paintball guns and mace into the crowds as they drove by. The whole awful day ended with a member of the right-wing street gang, Patriot Prayer, being shot and killed by a white BLM activist after charging him with a can of mace. Throughout all this, Portland's BLM marches occurred every single night, right up until late September, when a series of devastating wildfires overwhelmed Oregon and blanketed the city of Portland in a thick haze of poison. The nightly marches were halted, and the various mutual aid organizations that had started up to service the protests turned their efforts to meeting the needs of evacuees. Meanwhile, right-wing activists blamed the fires on Antifa and spent several days setting up illegal armed checkpoints and threatening people with rifles. When the rains came and the air cleared, the protests started up again. They were no longer nightly affairs, but they've remained regular occurrences ever since. And all of this begs the question, why Portland? All 50 U.S. states hosted Black Lives Matter protests during the summer of 2020. Many cities saw mass demonstrations. And while 93% of BLM protests were considered peaceful, numerous cities saw rioting, exchanges of gunfire, and even had buildings burnt down. But no city in the United States had as many continuous nights of protest as Portland. No city saw thousands of its citizens lay a weeks-long siege of a federal courthouse. No city experienced a 1,000-person street fight between right and left-wing demonstrators. Perhaps most importantly, no city earned the ire of President Donald Trump in the same way as Portland. It seems bizarre that this all would happen in Portland, a small city of about 653,000 people. How did it grow to become one of the most active front lines in a national battle for black lives and against white supremacy? It actually makes a lot of sense once you scratch beneath the surface a bit. Here's Tristan again.
Oregon was kind of founded as like something of like a white utopia, you know, like a place for the white man to really like find his destiny, right? And like conquer this, you know, this continent. And I think that's just kind of like, it's just like baked into the culture here where even like the love of the outdoors isn't like a love of keeping the environment like healthy and like balanced. It's just like a very like commodified, like we deserve this, you know, we deserve to live in this beautiful place and we're the only ones who know how to like take care of it. And obviously that's like mellowed out a little bit over the, you know, decades, but I think that's still basically like what it's like the undercurrent, you know, that's like behind most of what goes on in Oregon.
You can learn a lot of what you need to know about Oregon's history of racism by studying one of the state's founders, Peter Hardman Burnett. As a young man in Tennessee, he murdered a black person with a booby trap as revenge for petty theft. In 1843, he helped organize the first great wagon train of white people that headed to the Oregon Territory. He was elected to the provisional legislature and served as the territory's first Supreme Court justice. In 1844, he worked to pass what became known as Burnett's Lash Law. This stated that all black people were required to leave Oregon under penalty of being whipped in public, not less than 20 or more than 39 stripes. This punishment was to be repeated every 6 months until they moved. The law did include a grace period, 3 years for black women and 2 years for black men. Burnett also pushed to ban Chinese immigration into Oregon. While there are no documented instances of the lash laws being used, it set a clear tone for the state. Burnett's lash law reflected the values of the first white people who moved to Oregon. They were abolitionists in that they hated slavery, but they only hated slavery because they were revolted by the thought of living near black people. In 1848, the Oregon territorial government passed a law that banned any, quote, Negro or mulatto from living in Oregon. In 1850, the Oregon Donation Land Act gave whites and half-breed Indians, their, quote, 650 acres of land from the government. All other people of color were banned from the land grants. Oregon was finally made a state in February, 1859. Under its constitution, quote, no free Negro or mulatto not residing in this state at the time of the adoption of this constitution shall ever come, reside, or be within this state, or hold any real estate, or make any contract, or maintain any suit therein, and the legislative assembly shall provide by penal laws for the removal by public officers of all such free Negroes and mulattoes, and for their effectual exclusion from the state, and for the punishment of persons who shall bring them into the state, or employ or harbor them therein. Oregon remains the only state in the Union that ever banned black people from living there. Now, things have gotten better since 1859, but better is a low bar, and Portland remains the whitest metropolitan area in the United States. 77% of the population is white. Less than 6% is black. Today, Portland owns the distinction as one of the most gentrified cities in the United States. Oregon continues to report some of the worst graduation rates for black students in the nation, and the wealth gap between white and black Oregonians over the last 50 years has widened, not shrunk.
I moved to Portland like 5.5, 6 years ago, I think. And
from where?
From Northern California.
Gotcha.
Bay Area. Mm-hmm. And I didn't have a idea of what the city was per se. Like, I'd never seen an episode of Portlandia, for instance. I just kind of moved up here. I had to be closer to family. And when I kind of first got here, it was like, you know, that hang out with a bunch of like hippies, a bunch of like people who love trees and to ride bikes and go hiking. And it's like, oh, they love the environment and they love progressive, you know, politics and, you know, and everything's just chill. But then like